Recording was made on June 13, 1998, during the conference From the Realm of the Ancestors, Language of the Goddess. The subject is an emerging paradigm and features presentations by philosopher Marilyn Keller, art historian Susan Moulton, and ecofeminist writer-philosopher Charlene Spretnak. The conference was held at Cowell Theater, Fort Mason in San Francisco, and was sponsored by the Women's Spirituality Program of the California Institute of Integral Studies. The moderator is Joan Marler. A paradigm, a worldview, the way we perceive the world and each other, the constellation of ideas, attitudes, assumptions, beliefs that make up the frame, that make up the lens through which we perceive all of our experience. Something very dramatic, something deep, something profound is shifting as a natural consequence of a pendulum which is swung to its extreme, this alienation from the natural world, an alienation from our true nature, must spawn its opposite, the recognition that if we don't change our direction, we're bound to end up where we're headed. And here we are. We're at a time of great species extinction, the dying of the oceans, the cutting down of the forests of the world, the lungs of the planet, overpopulation. We know what's going on if we open our eyes and see. And that the source of all of this has to do with the human mind, the human spirit. What is it we hold sacred? And this change of paradigm, this change of worldview, this change of perception has everything to do with what is going on inside. And all the little shifts, all the little transformations make up the big one. And in this time of systems disequilibrium is the perfect time, is the only time for a tremendous change to take place. So catastrophic periods such as this are times of great opportunity. So to discuss this time of the emerging paradigm that we're in at the end of this millennium, we have three guests on our panel. They are Marilyn Keller, who is the Director of Women's Spirituality Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies, Susan Moulton, who's a Senior Professor of Art History at Sonoma State University, and Charlene Spretnak, who is the author of a number of essential texts. She's a philosopher ecofeminist who is also on the faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies. Mara?
Thank you, Joan. I've been feeling so many tears of joy last night and this morning. With the wonderful gifts of spirit that have been shared with us. I'm overflowing with happiness that we can all share this together. And it's part of what, to me, is the shift to a new paradigm. But more than that, I realize that in our desire to envision a new paradigm, it is also very much about a desire for a new way of life and a new world, a new culture, and that we're birthing that here amongst us. And this is a manifestation of this direction that we're moving in. And the reason we want a new world and a different way of life is for some of the reasons that Joan was mentioning and that we were learning about this morning, is that so much of what we have in the world is painful, is burdensome, is unhealthy, is a lot of suffering for people in the world, as well as the desecration of our Mother Earth and the devastation of the Earth and all of our relatives on the Earth, the non-human or more than human, as well as the human community. And so the work that we do together and the reason we bring forth our creative spirits to be shared with one another and nurtured with one another and to shift this direction of the way life is going on the planet as a whole, as well as in our local communities, is because we desire a community and a life that is more fulfilling, more exuberant, more ecstatic, more erotic, sensuous, artful, and loving. That's what we want, and it doesn't seem like too much to go for. So there are many guides and many wonderful sources that I am grateful for this morning, all of these beautiful people and brilliant artists and musicians and speakers are resources and nourishment for me. And I also want to say that the mythos of Demeter and Persephone has been very important to me through these years, because the story, as you know, of Demeter and Persephone, well, first for me, Persephone was very important because she was the one who would go into Hades and return. And there was one of these times when I was in hell and feeling stuck and not knowing how I would get out. A sister said to me, you know, Persephone returns. She does get out of hell. She knows her way out eventually. And have faith. So this is a faith that I took on, that even when I feel trapped in hell, and we all do, it's the human condition, whether we lose a loved one, someone who dies, we feel abducted, we're violated in many ways in this culture, in body, mind, and spirit. No matter how many times we feel abused or desecrated, or that our spirits get buried, that there is a way to return to wholeness, there is a path towards reunion, there is a way to come back to the loving source of the universe. And so this has been a faith and a guide for me. And as you probably know, there are different variants to the mythos of Demeter and Persephone. And a pre-patriarchal version was reconstructed for us by ecofeminist philosopher Charlene Spretnak in her early book, Lost Goddesses of Early Greece. We used to use this for our rituals in the late 70s when we'd celebrate Persephone's return in the spring in our ritual circles. So it was an inspiration to me to learn of a possibility of the time when Demeter and Persephone lived before the warrior clans took over the culture and asserted their dominant and dominating ways. And there was, for me, a great pleasure in learning the story of the mother and daughter, where the daughter looks about her and sees the lost and suffering souls who have not found peace, and she says to her mother, I must go to them, mother. And Demeter looks at her with sorrow and says, I understand why you must go. We cannot give only to ourselves. But for every day that you are gone, I will mourn your absence. My work is above ground, feeding the living, and I will be here, but I will await your return. And so Persephone then takes the poppies and the sheaves of wheat and descends into the underworld and meets there the milling spirits who are restless ghosts. And she goes to them and draws them to her and gazes into their eyes and says, you have waxed into fullness and waned into death. May you be renewed in tranquility and wisdom. And after she has done this work for a while, she then returns to above ground to rejoin her mother. And as they are reunited in joy, the plants and creatures of the world rise up in jubilation, and all humanity shares in the rejoicing of the reunion of mother and daughter. This very beautiful telling of the story was for me a reminder. When I think of it, it's the nurses, it's the midwives, it's the ones who tend the dying, it's the healthcare workers and the therapists, the one who goes into the jails, all those who serve in areas of suffering, and like Persephone, goes in order to be a compassionate witness to others in their time in the underworld. And this is a voluntary choice that so many, many make as ministers, as priestesses of spirit. So I like to think of many of us like Persephone doing this work of the goddess that is difficult and very rewarding. And then there's the other version of the mythos of Demeter and Persephone that is more familiar to us, which is the story of the abduction and rape of the daughter by Hades, who violently snatches her away from her girlfriends Athena and Artemis and all the daughters of Oceanus, descended, who come from the island of Crete. And she's dragged into the underworld against her will to become, by rape or by seduction, the bride of Hades. And she mourns the loss of her mother, and Demeter above ground mourns the loss of her daughter. Neither can eat. They're lost in despair, yearning to become reunited. And finally, because Demeter will not relent, Demeter becomes furious. There's a name for Demeter, Demeter Erinyes, Demeter the Furious. And she departs the company of gods. She will not stay on Mount Olympus. She goes to dwell among humans, disguised like an old woman. And while she is there, being nursemaid to a young son, Demophon, who represents by name all the people, she is made to laugh once again by Baubu, this outrageous, bodacious, lewd and vulgar and woman of great wisdom, who reminds her, remember where you come from. You are a woman, you are a mother. And she raises her skirts and shows her vulva, and Demeter breaks out laughing. This is too much for her. And she, with the laughter, breaks into her recovery. She begins to laugh. She takes nourishment then of the sacred drink, the Kikion, which is barley water, very nourishing, flavored with pennyroyal. And she drinks the sacred drink of communion, which is her connection again to the earth and to the fertile powers of life. And then there's another moment, I won't go into the whole story here, but there's another moment then when she has a temple built for her so her rites can be celebrated on the earth. But she misses her daughter and mourns and lapses into grief again. And finally, Zeus, who is no longer getting the offerings of the earth from the people because Demeter's powers of fertility were withdrawn for that time, accedes to her demands and has to have Persephone brought back from the underworld. And so he sends the messenger down, and Persephone is returned to the upper world. They run to meet each other. They embrace with great joy. And then, in the words of the ancient poet, all day long they bask in one another's presence, happy to be together and forgetful of sorrow. And each gives joy to the other and receives joy in return. Rarely in the literature of the world has the love of the mother for the daughter and of the daughter for the mother been celebrated with such beauty and sensitivity. So part of my desire for a new paradigm and a new world is my deep desire for this love between women to reemerge, this love among women of mother for daughter and daughter for mother to reemerge and to wash away and to heal and be the foundation from which we begin to build a new world, which in fact is able to nurture and sustain and raise up all the children as Demeter would want us to do. The work of Maria Gimbutas and her theory of the origins of Western civilization in Old Europe and the goddess civilization of Old Europe brings another important dimension to me as a guide and source of illumination for building this new world that we desire. Because in her discoveries of a goddess civilization in Old Europe, she finds there a culture that is egalitarian, that is peaceful, that is highly artistic, and reverenced the sacred life in every one, and manifested that in their ritual celebrations, in their dancing, in their exuberant artwork. So that's an example to us of this possibility for a whole civilization. And because of her work, we know that the warrior clans invaded and dominated, and in some places killed off, and in other places suppressed, and in other cases assimilated parts of the earlier goddess culture. And that subsequently, all of us, at least out of the European traditions, are heirs to this mixture of cultures, the warrior culture and its values, and the matristic or mother culture and its values. And that these are in contention and conflict and sometimes dynamic interplay and sometimes a clash. What Rian Eisler would call the resurgence of the partnership way or the regression of the dominator system. So this allows me a way to put together these two variants of the myth of Demeter and Persephone. The earlier time where the fruits of the earth were enjoyed freely and in abundance, and the cares and woes of the earth were attended to voluntarily. And this other way where we feel abducted against our will, forced into suffering, unknowing, forgotten, abandoned. And this is true for us these days. Both of these versions of the myth are true for us in these days. And they live within us and contend and conflict, and we feel pulled one way and pulled another way. And these are struggling cultures within us, within our psyches. And it's helpful to me to remember that as I go from day to day in this modern culture and deal with what all we have to deal with. Another guide that was important to me is the work of Rian Eisler in The Chalice and the Blade. And I especially want to focus on the cultural transformation theory, because that was another voice in the women's spirituality movement that gave me renewed hope at times when we were in despair. And this was still when we were facing the nuclear holocaust some years ago, before the stand down between the United States and Russia. And at that time, we didn't know if we were all going to evaporate in nuclear radiation or survive for a while longer. And what happened with when I read about the cultural transformation theory was the notion that these systems that we have, social systems, are organized around certain attractor points. And they can be, the strong attractor points can be dominator rule, strong man rule, male dominance, warrior gods, warrior values, and the society configures itself around that system. On the other hand, it could be the values of the more egalitarian or partnership culture, the values of peacefulness and cooperation, and the values of loving the earth, of bringing in all sexual choices and orientations, all racial freedoms in society, and a truly multicultural society and sexually egalitarian society and economically just society. That all these movements that have been fringe and marginalized in the dominator system could instead become the central values of a new social system. And the piece that's borrowed from chaos theory is that systems at times of stress, which we certainly are feeling, and distress, will begin to break down or deconstruct or dissolve and go into chaos and turbulence. And as Joan was saying, that's an important moment and possibility and opportunity for a new system to reappear and to configure rather swiftly out of this period of chaos into a new configuration around new attractor points. And so it's very important to me that we put our message out as clearly and as strongly and persuasively and attractively as we can, that we have great appeal, I believe, in the hearts of many for creating this new social system if we stand and speak or do whatever it is that we can do to draw ourselves and others towards this new nucleus of a way of life that would be loving and compassionate and feed all the children and tend to the cares and woes and soothe the suffering and raise up the creative spirits amongst us all to celebrate. And that gave me hope that we might be able to shift this culture around from the way it's going, even within the next couple of years for the new millennium, and have what we want in our lifetimes. You know, in the 60s, when I was young and, I don't know, more idealistic, but more naive, certainly, we wanted to change the world overnight, and we thought it would only take 5 years at most. And it's 30 years later, and we're still working at it. But we're having more pleasure in the process, I believe, at this time. And I'm hoping we'll get there for the new millennium. Finally, I would like to say that a couple of weeks ago, some personal remarks, as I was heading for my class on ancient Crete, which I love teaching, I decided to take with me this new set of goddess cards by Susan Seddon Bellay, the wonderful artist. And I passed them around the room, and we all drew a goddess message for ourselves for the day. And by chance and by coincidence, I drew the card of Demeter. For the first time, that's a new deck of cards I got for my birthday over at Gaia Books. And it was just the message that I needed, because I was in the midst of, you can imagine, the labor pains of birthing this conference, feeling a bit harried or tired or feeling like I was going through the descent every other day and so the struggle and the worry and all of that that goes with the complexities that we have in our communities. And so I realized that actually Demeter, well, in a new way, at a deeper level, that Demeter and Persephone are one, and that the descent into the underworld and the journey through struggle or suffering or even death is part of the process that we all go through so that we can return to fullness and be prepared to feed the people. And I thought, dear goddess, this is our job, to really have something that nourishes the people. And that when we look at Demeter and Persephone together, Persephone's journey is freeing the spirit, and Demeter's work is nourishing the soul. And so together, and these go together, because we don't learn how to do this unless we're able to go through our own descent and return and be with others in their descent and their return. And then we learn what it is that we can do for one another and how we can endure and how we can draw sustenance from the earth and from our community and the gifts and be nourished by the beautiful creativity that we all have to share with one another. And it's more than just, I don't mean spirit and soul in a disembodied way, but I really mean it's about nourishing ourselves in our bodies, in our minds, and in our spirits, in our fullness as women and as men, in our wholeness. Thank you. Thank you, Mara.
Susan Moulton.
Okay, thank you, Joan. 20 years ago, I started looking for women in art that weren't the object of the male gaze. And in books and writings and tradition, there wasn't much available to us. It was the 1960s, and it was the, you know, the rise of the feminist movement. I was in the middle of that and enjoying all of it and found it fulfilling, but it was still very polarized and limiting. And as I progressed through my educational career, I saw that this was an arena that needed a lot of help, because the the traditional discourse was very circumscribed and very patriarchal in its orientation. We all know that now in hindsight, but at the time, moving through it, it was very hard to ferret these different parts of the dilemma out. When I did my doctorate at Stanford, I worked on a very famous Renaissance artist by the name of Titian, and I was told in the process of writing my dissertation that I couldn't use scientific theory and cultural tradition and things that were outside the realm of aesthetics. And I thought, how very odd, because that's what goes towards making our culture rich and deep. Now we know that multicultural approaches are the best and the most fulfilling way to go, and Maria Gambutis, with her work and also just by the example of her life, has given us a model to follow. And more these women as models are emerging. I've spent a lot of my life researching the Virgin Mary, because she's so prominent in the history of Western art. And when I read Maria's work, suddenly I went back in time several millennia and started looking for the sacred feminine, which the Virgin Mary, of course, is the prime Western example and embodiment of. And I realized, as I started digging back in the past using Maria's references and images that aren't in traditional books, that there is indeed a very rich and an incredible past of women, but they've by and large been put under wraps, I like to say. They've been dressed and imprisoned. Cheryl's image of looking at the incarcerated woman through the slit, to me, is a really good metaphor for how we have to look through history to find our past. And we just get a little glimpse of it. But now that door is beginning to open, and it's becoming very, very exciting. And so my work now is dealing with the privy parts of the goddess. I ran across a quote of Herodotus by Diodorus Siculus, and I'll paraphrase it for you. And the quote essentially said that when the Greek army came across a city that put up a good fight and resisted colonization, then they would put up a stele or herm outside that city that had the privy parts of a male. But if the city was passive and didn't put up much of a fight and was largely peaceful, then they would put up a stele or a marker with the privy parts of a female. And I thought, isn't that interesting? The privy parts of the female are very potent. They're very powerful. Certainly Maria's work has revealed all of that. But in our culture, they're under wraps. They're draped. And by the classical period, the sacred feminine parts were largely draped, except for the figure of Venus. My work in art history centers on the city of Venice, which is the city named after the eponymous goddess Venus. It's where her name comes from, the Venetians. It's an island city like Malta and Crete. It rises up out of the waters. We're sitting here in a building and we're completely oblivious of the water around us, but it is a birth metaphor. These cities are in watery canals and they're living bodies of nature. So the Venus Anadyomene is a Venus that rises up out of the sea, and that's the goddess of Venice. And it's a living myth in which the sacred reproductive parts, as she emerges from the ocean, are beautifully celebrated, and they have been since the beginning of time. So I started going back in history, and I found that in the classical period, the priestesses at the temple who educated people in the sacred sexual rituals gradually became courtesans and hetairae and prostitutes. But they were still powerful women. Venice had the most world-renowned courtesans of its time in the Renaissance. These were educated women who had independence, who had a sense of themselves, and who demonstrated a different kind of sacred femininity. The goddess Venus and the Virgin Mary were conflated in the city of Venice. They merged together. And I found that very interesting also. And I think in our history, the vestiges of this ancient culture are there like markers along a trail for us to find if we just look at them. They're sitting there like those markers outside those cities. So my work now traces the evolution of these privy parts from the reclining, sleeping, dreaming, meditative goddess in Malta all the way through the figure of the reclining Venus in the work of Titian in Venice, who, if you haven't looked closely at that picture by Giorgione of the reclining Venus and one by Titian, she's autoerotic. It's one of the first times that we see, outside of the ancient figure of Balbo, a self-pleasuring figure of a woman in a very blatant and obvious painting over life size. And when I did my research more, I realized that Titian grew up in a village in the subalpine area outside Venice, where the pagan tradition was very strong. Venice is a very heterogeneous, heterodox city that thrives on diversity because it's a trade city. And so Jews and Asians and people of all races, along with women, were widely respected. And it was a strange presence in the world, because some vestiges of this ancient Neolithic culture survived into the Renaissance. And in the work of Titian and a number of other artists, they begin to emerge. And they emerge to a group of people that understand and revive the goddess, who study Ovid and who study Hermes Trismegistus and some of the other wisdom traditions that are very much alive in these populations that exist side by side in Venice in peace and tranquility. And a new paradigm for the sacred feminine emerges in Venice, and it's unlike anything you find anywhere else in the world. I had known this all intuitively as I was working on this culture, but I could never put it into a larger context to say, yeah, this is what we can gather from this information and put into practice in our own culture today. So here's an example in the past of a kind of a residue of what Maria described as this Neolithic culture of tolerance and compassion and collaboration, albeit it was still patriarchal, but it had a republican government where everybody had a voice. It had the first social poor laws that protected women and children in a time when tens of thousands, if not millions, of women were being exterminated as witches, which was a euphemism for being in the way or being landholders or being pagans who carried this rich older tradition with them. So Titian, who became the leading artist in his time in the 16th century in the world, We don't know that because we're so tied into the rational mind. We think of Michelangelo, we think of Leonardo, we think of Raphael, we think of Rubens, we think of a lot of other artists who are very tied into a patriarchal tradition of form before emotion, but in Venice it was emotion before form. And so sexuality, human sexuality, was rich and diverse, and the courtesans were the were sought out by the crowned heads and the wealthiest people in Europe, not for their sexual favors, but for their education, for their ability to discourse on philosophy, like the ancient courtesan of Pericles Aspasia, who was supposed to have inspired many of his famous speeches and writings. So courtesans and prostitutes, the Magdalene, for instance, in the scriptures, there's no source for her having been a prostitute in the scriptures. This is a patriarchal story that's overlaid on the scriptures. And so we can dig back in our past, and in the city of Venice, many of these artists and writers and thinkers were privy to this arcane tradition, this tradition under wraps, and Titian encoded it in his paintings. So there are overt references to vernacular tradition, to the glorification of the rich sexual parts of the woman, the breasts, the vulvas, knowing oneself, that has lain dormant in history because our culture won't allow us to look at that, won't allow us to celebrate it or to understand it really. So my work now is encoding, is decoding these gestures, these little hints in images that exist throughout culture, like these markers through history, that help us into a new understanding of ourselves and what we can celebrate and understand and be less embarrassed about. So I encourage you, I don't have an opportunity to show you slides, but I encourage you to look at some of that information. It used to be when I was an undergraduate in school that there were three lines in the standard textbooks, which were 700 pages, devoted to women. There was no mention of a woman artist. Now they're token women, and suddenly there's more and more interest as their work is being shown in usually provincial galleries. The Rodin Museum in Paris, if anybody's been there 20 years ago, it had Camille Claudel's portrait bust of him, and 15 years ago it had a few of her pieces, and 2 years ago it had two rooms of her work. So we're making headway, but in order to create this new paradigm, what I would like to think of as a cultural overhaul, we have to have images, we have to have models, we have to become more visible, and we can't lapse into the embarrassment that has plagued us for centuries because our privy parts have been deemed evil or sinful. It's my personal belief that when Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, it's a metaphor for the transition that took place when the goddess culture was kicked out of its own garden, so to speak, which was taken over. So I guess what I'm saying is that we need to have the courage to reevaluate the material that we're given in whatever context we face, and to focus, as Mara and others have said, on the collaboration, on the nurturing, on the reverence for nature that made this ancient Neolithic so important for us today. In the Renaissance, it was believed that God had created nature. This is something we find in Hermes Trismegistus, the Egyptian Moses, and that that nature was a metaphor for the goddess, and that love and the body of the goddess, especially the sexual parts of the goddess, were created by God so he could enjoy his own creation. And therefore, nature was to be nurtured and revered. But this was all an underlay of the Christian overlay that came into being with the canonization of the faith by Constantine, the Roman emperor. So we have to ferret out all of this to find our real inherent values, and the privy parts of the goddess are among the most powerful images and metaphors that we have. And many of us have grown up in a culture. I know when I had my first child, one didn't breastfeed one's child. And I had to fight in the hospital for the privilege of breastfeeding my child. Now it's something we can all enjoy and that we can all do and nurture and become more cohesive with our birthrights. So I think it's time to take women out from under their wraps and to celebrate her glorious nudity as some of these enlightened artists did in the past. And I would like personally to thank Maria and the people who brought us all together here today. Living in a world of men, it's so rare that we get such a wonderful support and such a resonance in the same room. You don't have to preach to the uneducated. You don't have to sit and wonder why the room is silent when you finished giving a talk. So I'd like to thank you all for being here and for making my work easier.
Thank you, Susan. Charlene Spretnik.
Mm-hmm. Our plan here was for the old European, and then the Renaissance, and then the contemporary. So I have just enjoyed listening to this so much. I don't know if you realize, Mara was reciting the key passages out of my version of Demeter and Persephone that I wrote 25 years ago. I could never recite them. And, apparently not having any middle-aged memory problems, Mara. And then the art history also ties into something that I want to say, because although I do want to talk about contemporary issues, I want to begin by looking at the resonance that the artifacts in Maria Gimbutas's books had for us 20 years ago and still do, and how they sparked certain responses in us. And because I want to start talking about the artifacts, I want to share with you this new book that I came across the day before yesterday, which is the Guerrilla Girls Bedside Companion to the History of Western Art. And it's just published in 1998, and the Guerrilla Girls are an anonymous group of artists in New York, and it's spelled guerrilla, as in insurgents, but they wear guerrilla costumes, so they can be anonymous when they're challenging the big museums and the galleries in New York, who never feature women artists, right? Oh. All right, there are branches all over now, I'm told. But the point of this book is that it starts with the Greeks. See, Maria ran into this all the time. Anything before the Greeks is lost in the mist of time. We can never know what went on. That used to drive her crazy, I think, more than any phrase she would hear from the general public, not from anyone who knew archaeology, of course. So it's very interesting that even to this group of activists, they don't understand that, as Susan was saying, our history goes back much further than the canon. Their theme in here is, let's fire the cannon. but you see the same thing in philosophy, actually. If you open a text on philosophy, or for instance, a reference book like the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it will say the pre-Socratics, who were very organic and holistic, were the only school of philosophy to have no precedents, no predecessors. That's really amazing, because I think that one of the effects of the work of Maria and other people on the pre-Greek, the pre-Indo-European, is to shift our whole view of what, for instance, the pre-Socratics were about. They'll now be viewed as a bridge between the older holistic view and the new hierarchical patriarchal view. The pre-Socratics just quickly each put out a different guess as to what was the actual nature of reality. It was all water, or it was really all air, or it was all flux. But each one of them had this holistic sense of the wholeness of humans and the natural world. Well, where did that come from? It came from 35,000 years of this holistic orientation that's documented so well in the old European artifacts. I'm wanting to begin by wondering why these artifacts struck such a deep chord with us when we first saw them. And I think that one reason it was possible that we had that response to them was that we'd gone through our own passage in the 60s. If we'd seen these powerful female nude bodies, so different from anything in our culture, while we were in the 50s, I don't think we could have connected. I mean, it was so buttoned down and repressed. You know, we go, what is this? Is this from another planet? What could this have to do with us? Turn the page. As a lot of women did who, I don't know, couldn't make that leap. But for a lot of people who went through the 60s and with our goal in the counterculture of resacralizing the erotic and honoring the body as a site of the sacred, when we saw these figurines, these powerful female figurines, I think it was more possible for us then to have this connection. So it seemed to me that in my experience and that of others, when we studied these artifacts, the plates in Maria Gimbutas's books, that we saw three possibilities that were so alien to the culture we were in that they were quite exciting. And the first one was that a lot of the figurines are half human and half animal. I was thinking just a few days ago of the ones that are half bird and half female. And it suddenly occurred to me, talk about someone who's slow on the pickup after 20-some years. I always loved that one, the one that's half bird and half female. And I remembered that when I was 7, 8, and 9 years old, I was a bluebird. Now, if any of you were bluebirds or remember our sweet little costumes, which were quite different from the other organization from girls, not to cast aspersions, but some people did think their uniforms were a little militarist. So anyway, we dressed up like birds. We were bird girls, right? And once a week, for the day of our group meeting, we had these little blue hats with bills on them, and we had a white blouse and a navy blue skirt, and we had vests that were red in the front like the bluebird and blue on the back. So we were bird girls. And I think maybe that, you know, planted the seeds. So there I saw that figurine and I thought, yes, that's right. Well, there's more, of course. I went to the Bluebirds and Campfire Girls camp for 11 summers, which people say, how did you end up being an eco-feminist? Oh, well, I went to a girls' camp in beautiful Hocking Hills of southeastern Ohio every summer. So it was my experience, a women's society. Women are competent to figure out everything, work out the logistics, and make a little society that worked beautifully. And it was deeply embedded in beautiful nature. So the combination was, again, oh, eco-feminism, right, that sounds right. Anyway, back to this. So I think these statues that were half animal and half human, and also the statues of the women's bodies incised with water, this obviously indicated that they had a sense of our deep and subtle embeddedness in the natural processes. And this has been clear to all native cultures, as far as we can tell. And some people call these old Europeans, you know, the native Europeans. But this was lost. It was lost when we took that turn into the rationalist Greek world. And of course, after the pre-Socratics, there's the famous story Plato recorded of Socrates being invited to stroll outside the gates of Athens with a friend, and they go outside and come to this beautiful plane tree, and his friend says, "It's so beautiful here, isn't it? You must come here often." And Socrates says, "No, I never come here. What could I learn from a tree? I learn from men in cities." So the double whammy, men in cities, we took a certain course. And to ecological men, our allies, of course, they can see this course was very wrong, and there's been a resistant stream ever since we took that course away from our embeddedness in the natural world. But in the dominant culture, it's largely absent, the sense of our deep connection, because modern culture has progressed with this idea that, you know, progress, the very nature of progress, comes about in opposition to nature. So that's why, amazingly, even in this 11th hour, when it comes to certain ecological crises, it's still able to keep it off the table of discussion in Washington and Sacramento. So I'll come back to that. But a second possibility, besides the fact that a culture could recognize it's deeply embedded in the natural processes, is, of course, the fact that in almost all of these old European cultures that Maria and many of her Central European colleagues excavated, there was no evidence that these societies lived with warfare as the so-called organizing principle known to so many of the cultures later on. So, of course, the fact that there were the three general kinds of evidence that archaeologists look for, there were no caches of weapons, no fortifications, and no mass graves of bodies that were all killed with like spear wounds or weapon wounds, you know. The absence of all three of those indicates that they had figured out ways to live in peace with their neighbors. So during the peace movement in the early 80s, I and I'm sure other people wrote articles, because we were hearing all the time, well, war is natural. War is the way of, you know, the human race. It's completely stupid to talk about outlawing it. We can just manage it. So it was quite important to see that there are many cases when indeed other choices have been made by cultures. And then the third possibility that the artifacts suggested to us was a culture that honors women. You know, what would that be like? I put a piece in the anthology, The Politics of Women's Spirituality, which I started editing in 1979, a piece from Adrienne Rich's book of Woman Born, when she talked about her response to seeing these goddess statues and how different they were from the way we're used to seeing women depicted. And it took her a while to be able to drop deeply into their meaning and appreciate them. But then she wrote, "She, the goddess, is beautiful in ways we have almost forgotten. Her body possesses mass, interior depth, inner rest, and balance." Hold that thought, because I think that's extremely important to what we need today. And a few months ago, I had a shocking experience. I was nattering on in my philosophy class and teaching a French philosopher, Luce Idigare, and she's very much a philosopher of embodiment, which is a small group of philosophers today. And she was quite condemned by feminist philosophers for 15 and even 10 years ago for being essentialist. And now she's embraced as the most famous leading, that is, feminist philosopher working in the world today. So I was discussing her book that she actually wrote in 1979, although it wasn't translated for 10 years over here, when she talks about the fact that we could have a dynamic culture, a vital culture, with a dynamic conversation between males and females if women find their voice and the expression of their authentic experience. But that's never happened for 2,000 years. So we have a monotone conversation. Language, philosophy, medical system, all of our training has evolved from the Greeks through the medieval period, Renaissance, the birth of modernity, and especially with modernity intensifying characteristics that are comfortable to male socialization. So she, like myself, believes that indeed there is a profound connection between passing through this life in a female or male body form. And this should be explored instead of just paved over with one norm. The male is the norm. And I was explaining her feeling, and you know, it suddenly occurred to me when she said, "We have not found our voice, our authentic expression of our being," that that's exactly what we were trying to do in the late 70s, the mid 70s and the late 70s. What some people call, without fondness or with fondness, the white heat of feminism years. Okay, it was a little rough, but in the Bay Area especially, and many other pockets across the country, in the women's spirituality circles, that's exactly what you're trying to do. You know, make circles out on the grass, connect with nature, body, place. What is our authentic spirituality? You know, it just didn't feel like what we've been raised to was reflecting our authentic spirituality. And so I thought, you know, that's what we were doing, and she didn't know anything about that when she wrote this in 1979. Why do I know she didn't know anything about what we were doing? Because all of us who wrote books on women's spirituality were always told by the publisher, well, you've got some interest in a translation in, you know, a British edition, and then a translation in Germany, Italian, maybe Spanish, but not French, not the France, and not in France. The French have no interest in this spiritual stuff, you know. They're protecting the humanist project. So nothing was ever translated in French. And I know she didn't know what we were doing then, but she was writing almost exactly the same thing, which, of course, as I say, is now embraced by academic philosophers who have complete disdain for women's spirituality. But it was the same project as what she's talking about. And it just hit me that, you know, yes, that's what we were doing then, but no one has been even trying for a very long time. Not in the way we were, in the collective, large-scale way we were. Many people still have been trying to reach that deep level, of course, and express it. But things happened. What happened? You know, in the early 80s, there was the nuclear buildup, the peace movement. It was all on this hair trigger, computerized system and expanding all the time, utter madness, and so feminists threw themselves into the peace movement to good effect. And then, you know, what came after that? Reaganomics, all the suffering, that's in the phrase, the feminization of poverty, really became a reality for so many women. And on and on. So what I'd like to propose is that we need to renew that quest to find our authentic sense of being, and I think the practices of women's spirituality are one very powerful path into that, and find it not only for the sake of our own authenticity, which is a large enough reason, but also so that we can bring that to our engagement with the crises of our times. You know, there's something wrong with fixing the problems and still having everything feel so completely inside out to us. So we have to really speak from a deep critique. And I think, as both of the speakers have said, that will be based quite a bit on our insistence on more compassionate ways of doing things. I saw in the paper a while ago this study again on measuring compassion in young women and men on campuses. They do it every 4 years or something. And the percentages hold steady through all the cultural changes, you know, over 15 years. The young women are much more compassionate. They're much more bothered to see someone being beaten up or, you know, harassed or put down. It doesn't bother the young men as much. I am not saying this is biological. There may be a problem, and I know there's a problem with the way we're raising young men in this country. They don't have the wholesome initiation rites that a lot of the native cultures did. In fact, young men and young women are just sacrificed to the consumerist culture at a fairly early age. But I want us, as we engage deeply and not standing for just putting Band-Aids on things, to be aware of what we're up against. Because I think the reason a lot of ecological and feminist efforts to make changes have bounced off a brick wall, as it were, and not understood why they weren't getting through is because the interlocking assumptions and values of modernity are not always understood, because we're taught in school that it's just the natural way. This is, you know, where you end up through this advanced stage of the human race. You end up in modernity. But I want to just quickly name a few of those assumptions so we can have them in mind. Every one of these seems wrong, I think, to the compassionate orientation. One is the assumption that humans are essentially homo economicus. You know, we're essentially the economic animal, and that's at the core, and every other relationship is tangential and just works out from that. Well, a lot of native cultures, we can certainly see in the old European cultures, they consider that completely inside out. At the core is your relationship with the cosmos. And you're part of the cosmos, your bioregion, your ecosystem, and your clan, your family, your nation, your area, and then the whole human family, and then the whole earth community, all the species, the rivers, and the health of all that. That would be a more sane approach. But just quickly to go through these assumptions of industrialism, we're completely caught up in that. Well, we can't really preserve this because obviously we need to have this much expansionism. And progressivism, I do want to make this point. It's very dangerous and it's held by most people today, especially a lot of theorists. You know, we started out in this primitive society, and then we've just made this straight progression up to where we are today. Modernity depends on this blind faith in progressivism, which means we're always being delivered to a better time and place. So there's no reason learning from the past, and there's certainly no point in studying something that might have been lost in the past, some crucial sensibilities. I mean, obviously, we made turns, we gained some things, and we lost some things. What we lost was quite essential in many respects. So the rationalism, the scientism, the bureaucratization, all this made a lot of sense to some people, but it doesn't to most women and ecological men. Contempt for indigenous peoples. All these values of modernity were held by communist and capitalist states as well, because that whole spectrum is embedded in the worldview of modernity, which is intensely anti-nature, and it intensified the anti-female orientation already in the West at that time. So this shrinking of the cosmological context to the size of the human project. The main thing is, with this orientation we've inherited, that the problematic core of it is the belief that there are three discontinuities, three radical breaks, that there's a radical break between humans and the rest of the natural world, that there's a radical break between body and mind, and that there's a radical break between self and the rest of the world. So humans and nature, body and mind, and self and the world. And I think we need to keep those core problems central. You'll see everything really spinning off from those, all the way our institutions have developed and the crises in them. So we need to be working at that level as well as what are the immediate problems. And I want to end by talking, as our assignment was, about the emergent paradigm. My husband asked me what the topic of the panel was, and I said the emerging paradigm, and he says, "Oi, why don't you just call it the emerging paradigm? What's taking so long?" Because we both worked in green politics for a long time, and the point I'd like to make is that it could also be called the convergent paradigm. The emergent paradigm is the convergent paradigm, lots of pieces of the alternative political world coming together. For instance, for 20 years, the green parties around the world, there are now 70, have been saying what we need is community-based economics. And this is now emerging in many more quarters than the Greens as the counterforce to globalization. You know, we live now in this new world order where GATT did an end run around the United Nations and just gave a carte blanche to the transnational corporations, redefined free trade. So it means the transnationals are free to do anything they want, nobody else is, because they can challenge any law inside a country they don't like, any ecological law or labor-protecting law. So community-based economics would keep most of the money circulating within a community, a city, a region, building up regional trade instead of money going out to distant corporate headquarters immediately as soon as a purchase is made. And many areas of California, are, especially Arcata, by the way, have been seriously putting this into effect with good results. So I was delighted to see that in the statement that came out of the International Women's Conference in Beijing, among the main themes, the one, of course, was stopping violence against women. The other one, they said, what the women of the world want is community-based economics, not a job in the transnational factory going into every third world community, but rather these small-scale opportunities for women, combined, of course, with good health care and good educational opportunities. So I want to end with this little memorial prayer for victims of modernity. And you'll see that all these people who have suffered a lot are the very groups that are coming together. And we're very aware of this in California, Native people working in coalitions with feminists, environmentalists, and others. But I came to write this prayer when I was writing my last book, The Resurgence of the Real. I sent the book proposal to an old friend of mine from college who's a hyper-rationalist guy, and I wanted to see what he'd think of this. And it's a critique of modernity and also talking about our heritage of resistance to modernity, these movements over the past 200 years, and then the positive vision. So he just went ballistic. The book proposal came back covered with red ink, and you know, all these comments. And what are you talking about? What the world are you talking about? You know, he describes himself as a bureaucrat and a damn good one. And so he said, "You're critiquing modernity. This is who we are. This is, you know, this doesn't even make any sense. I can't. What are you talking about?" So I thought, "Oh, okay." Apparently, the downside of modernity is not obvious to everyone who's schooled in this system. And we're only used to seeing, you know, the pre-modern as the time when people were abused and beaten up and all those stupid prejudices that the Enlightenment brought us out of the dark into the light and rescued us from. So that's how this little prayer came to be. Those who champion modernity like to remind malcontents that pre-modern life was full of superstition, persecution, and various irrational cruelties. This is true. Far from eradicating socially induced suffering, however, the modern worldview merely changed the rules of what was accepted and expected, and upped the ante as technology enabled the imposition of increasingly devastating cruelties on an increasingly large scale. Let us indeed remember with resolve and compassion the victims of pre-modern times, those who were mocked for being insufficiently pious, or ostracized from their medieval village, or required to live in circumscribed areas of medieval cities, or terrorized by threats of fire and brimstone, or stoned or murdered. But let us also memorialize the casualties of modernity, those who raised objections that were crushed by the arrogance of the new worldview with its absolute certainties. To all the women who risked their lives in the American and French revolutions only to discover the patriarchal character of the Enlightenment, which was never meant for them. To all the country people whose love for the earth and its cycles made them objects of contempt in the modern urban mind. To all the native people who resisted genocide and forced assimilation, modernity's fate for those considered backward. To all the victims of mass murder by fascist regimes using modern bureaucratic efficiency and disengaged instrumental reason. To all the people brutalized and murdered by Marxist armies and police because they resisted the so-called scientific theory of history. To all who fought to save their communities and livelihood from the callous control of giant corporations and cartels. To all the parents who pleaded with officials of the industrialized state to recognize the connection between radiation or toxic dumping and their malformed or sickly children. To all the people who persevered in cultivating a spiritual life, even though they were mocked as irrational. And to all those children who tried valiantly to hold on to their early sense of the world as wondrously creative and vibrantly alive, even as they were jammed into the grid of modern schooling. We here declare that you were right. You were right, and your suffering was not in vain. Your tears have fertilized the earth, from which now grow more resistance efforts than can be counted, more resilience than can be known.
Thank you, Charlene. I'd like to let you know that all of our panelists are included in this anthology from the Realm of the Ancestors, as are most of the presenters at this conference. The piece that Charlene Spritnick wrote for the section An Emerging Paradigm is entitled Beyond the Backlash and Appreciation for the Work of Maria Gimbutas. And the piece that Mara Lynn Keller wrote under the same An Emerging Paradigm section is called The Interface of Archaeology and Mythology, a Philosophical Evaluation of the Gimbutas Paradigm. And under the section The Artistic Vision, Susan Moulton wrote Titian's Assunta as Iris Gamos. So if you're interested to read more, it's in this anthology. I regret that we don't have time for discussion, that we could be here, I think, for the rest of the day with this incredible material. But I do want to give our panelists the time for just a brief concluding remarks. We'll begin with Mara.
I should start. I just want to thank Mara, who has worked around the clock, I mean fingers to the bone, to pull this off. That's what I'm getting to. And for years, this anthology she's talking about was such an enormous task. And she was such a wonderful editor. At the same time, the journalist on feminist studies and religion at Harvard School of Divinity was doing a special issue on Maria. And so some of us had our articles in both places. And certain things got by the Harvard gals, but nothing got by Joan.
I'll say one brief word. I'm overwhelmed with joy, and so is Joan. We are happy beyond words that we're all here sharing what we're sharing, and thank you all for being here.
This is the emerging paradigm in action.
Well, maybe we are the emerging paradigm, yes. And we really can make a difference, and so I'd like to honor us all. And thank you again, Mara and Joan, and all of the people behind the scenes doing the lighting and the flowers and the desks outside and the books. I mean, it's a collaborative community effort on a local scale that extends around the globe.